Hello, everybody, and welcome to the history of actor training in the British Drama School. I hope you're having a good summer. If you're enjoying these podcasts, there are three ways to support them. You can leave a review. You can drop me an email on robertprice1869@gmail.com. Or, of course, you could leave a donation. There's a like button on the Buzzsprout site, and on the bottom of the Apple thing, and I think as well on Spotify. I think there are ways. Anyway, thank you so much for those people who support the show. Hugely appreciated. This week, we're going to continue asking questions about Stanislavski's effect on the British Drama School. And I was particularly taken with a phrase that I found in a paper by Vladimir Mirodan, where he described how, in his opinion, Stanislavski is hidden in plain sight. He's spoken about by acting teachers, people read his book, an actor prepares in the Elizabeth Hapgood translation. But really, really, there's no sort of coherent even attempt to apply Stanislavski's ideas about acting into the actual practice of the drama school, either from a Russian tradition or from the American tradition, which we now think of as the method, and we now think of as separate from Stanislavski. Something that's been interesting about doing this research is I've realized that when I was young, I think for me those two terms were very much sort of, or two ideas, Stanislavski and the method, were very much sort of collapsed in on each other. So I thought of them as being the same thing. And then I started to really separate them out in a way which I think it's all really complicated. But looking back on material from the 50s and the 60s, the terms are synonymous. So the American method, when it's being written about at that period, certainly in the things I've read, is considered to be the same thing as Stanislavski's system, which is just interesting to me. The division obviously comes late enough conceptually that it hadn't landed in my head as just a sort of reasonably educated young man in Britain in the 1980s. So I find that curious. So the sort of the received history is that Stanislavski doesn't become taught in British drama schools, really, until the foundation of the Drama Centre in 1963. And the person who teaches it is a woman called Doreen Cannon. And we're going to talk about her lots soon. I wanted to read these two texts. One is by Charles Marowitz. And Charles Marowitz is a really interesting figure. I'm starting to get really curious about Charles Marowitz. He comes over to Britain in the mid-1950s. He comes and studies at Lambda on the one-year course, which had only just been set up, but is still going. So if you look on Lambda's website, you'll find now there's an MA in classical acting. Within the building, it's known as the D course, D because it was the sort of the fourth course. There was a three-year course that eventually became a BA, the A year, the B year, and the C year. And then there was this other thing called which became known as the D's. Penny Churns, who we're going to talk to next week, and who actually features in Simon Callow's account of the Drama Centre that I'm going to read, ran that course for a number of years. Charles Marowitz, when he comes, it's one of the first years it runs, and he kind of hates it, and he kind of hates Lambda. Marowitz is a New Yorker. He's very much somebody who's interested in the method. And after he leaves Lambda and Central in the 1950s, he's really vocal in his criticism of English training methods, of English theatre, of English directing methods. There are lots of articles by him in The Stage and other newspapers. Eventually, he becomes very much involved in a magazine called Encore. We're going to meet Charles Marowitz more over the next wee while, because I find him really fascinating. He wrote a biography about his time in an autobiography about his time in England, which is a kind of a fantastic read. And in it, he writes a pretty damning account of his training at Lambda. It's interesting. Now Marowitz, I think, is a quite a salty kind of a character. So a little bit like Peter Ustinov's famously naughty description of training under Michel Saint-Denis at the London Theatre Studio, I think we should take Marowitz's account with a pinch of salt. He's certainly somebody who, as he says himself, doesn't suffer fools gladly and was endlessly falling out with all kinds of people and getting fired from jobs. So I think he's a very particular type of person. But nonetheless, his account is interesting because if you compare it with Simon Callow's account of going to the Drama Centre in 1970, you can really sense, I think, the huge earth shift that had taken place in the British Drama School between the mid-1950s and 1970. I mean, an astounding change, at least in the Drama Centre. And this is interesting to me, and I hope to some of us, because I'm starting to get a sense, almost a thesis, I suppose, if I was writing this down, that what tends to happen is that you have periods of criticism which sort of emerge into public consciousness or into specialist press or into the public square of debate, as it were. And you can really see how that happened at the end of the 19th century. There's a lot of talk about the decline of stock companies, acting standards. There's stuff to do with morality, I think, especially around actresses. This leads to the first academies being set up. Then, as you move into the 1930s, there's an intense dissatisfaction with the quality of our theatre. English actors and theatre makers are looking abroad to what's happening in Russia and what's happening in France, and they're yearning for an art theatre. That leads to certainly Michel Saint-Denis' two schools either side of the Second World War. And then I think at this period, what happened with Saint-Denis' experiment obviously didn't land deeply enough. There isn't a fundamental change. And you have a sort of an echo of this dissatisfaction, only now it's being filtered through a more sort of countercultural lens and a more method-focused lens. And that leads, I think, to the foundation of the Drama Centre and East 15, those two experimental schools. The Drama Centre is about to disappear. East 15 is going strong now as part of the University of Essex. And I would say probably the fourth wave is the one that's been taking place over the past couple of years, which is a combination of criticism from a social justice or equity point of view, combined with something similar, a connected but different argument to do with actors as theatre makers, an entrepreneurial curriculum, something that encourages people to sort of take ownership of their creativity, and that's connected with material which is maybe more post-dramatic in its form, more physical theatre. So there's something sort of complicated going on, but again, some kind of critical mass has been focused towards what we could think of as the Drama School. Also, what's happened is sort of huge changes in terms of the Drama School's relationship with HE. And, of course, the kind of curious and fairly unremarked phenomenon where universities now offer BAs in acting. So I was glancing through government websites to do with the NSS recently, and I discovered that there are now nearly 100 BA acting courses in the United Kingdom, very close. It's in the 90s, so close to 100. And that actually, that data is from last year, so I wouldn't be surprised if a few more courses have opened up. So we're certainly very soon, I think, have a situation where there are 100 courses in acting in something like, I think there were 67 institutions. Now, only about 20 odd of those are what you might call conservatoires, drama schools. That means that 40 or 50 of them are essentially universities. So the distinction between the university drama department and the drama school teaching acting, that really seems to be collapsing. And again, that's something that's been argued for. So we see this kind of cycle of criticism, attention, consideration, argument, leading to change. And the two pieces I'm going to read for you today, I think to some degree illustrates that change. So I'm going to begin with just a very brief history of how the course which Charles Marowitz took came to exist. Michael McCowan, who Marowitz mentions, not very complimentarily, had only fairly recently taken over Lambda. We'll talk about Michael McCowan another time in detail, but my feeling is that Michael McCowan was somebody who wanted to innovate training, but perhaps at this point hadn't really figured out how. I think he was a sort of a figure whose methodology, ideas, aesthetics, perhaps were connected to the pre-war period, although he had taught in Saint-Denis's Old Vic School. But and Michael McCowan, along with Norman Ayrton, I think are the two figures who could be said to be responsible for Lambda having the international reputation it once had, a reputation which I suspect may be tottering slightly at the moment. But Lambda's reputation is based on the McCowan and Ayrton years. It's interesting that Charles Marowitz is so scathing, and that may, as I said, be partly because Marowitz is given to being scathing, and it may also be because it was quite early in McCowan's tenure, and he may not really have worked out how he wanted to do what he eventually did, I think, very successfully. But anyway, this is a little history of how the one-year course came to exist. Some of you listening may have taken that course, so you may find this interesting. In 1955, McCowan was pleased to report to the Council, that's the Council of Lambda, that as a result of the number of distinguished foreign visitors who have inspected the work of the Academy during the past year through the agency of the British Council and the International Theatre Institute, the work of the Academy appears to be arousing a great deal of interest abroad. There are at present students at Lambda from Chile, Israel, France, Rhodesia, New Zealand, Tasmania, India, 9 from the United States, and 6 from Canada. So that's quite an international cohort. Interesting. 1955. So, with the encouragement of the International Theatre Institute and the United States Educational Commission in Great Britain, he set up a one-year course in classical acting for advanced students from abroad, principally Fulbright scholars from the United States, the first batch of whom arrived in 1956. Fulbright scholarships were at that time the only international scholarships open to American women. So Marowitz comes on the GI Bill, which I think was, I'm not an expert on American military educational history by any means, but I think ex-GIs got, maybe they still get some help, I think they do still get some help, sort of funding, once they leave the military. Lambda still has, or certainly had when I was teaching there a year and a half ago, Fulbright scholars, but not many. So I think there was one Fulbright scholar on the MA. But at this point, it seems to be principally Fulbright scholars. The person who wrote this history, and I don't know who it is. This is a document I found in a library. I'm actually sure who wrote it. But in this document, whoever wrote this document doesn't seem to know that there were also students who came on the GI Bill, like Marowitz. Variously called the Advanced Course or the Overseas Course, it offered 10 students 3 terms of 11 weeks each to study the English classics from Shakespeare to Shaw. It also included, towards the end of the year, work on the plays of Christopher Fry and T.S. Eliot, modern playwrights who were about to be overshadowed by kitchen sink plays such as John Osborne's. I think we know what this is going to be. Look Back in Anger at George Devine's Royal Court and Sheila Delaney's A Taste of Honey at Joan Littlewood's Stratford East, which made regional accents and working class themes all the rage and provoked a reaction against the elegant verse dramas of Eliot and Fry. The course, which has never been exclusively filled by Americans, although a majority are normally Americans, broadened the age range and experience of the student body. On Anna Calder Marshall's year, a mixed bag of Northerners, Cockneys, upper class, intellectuals and artists, the overseas visitors made a powerful impression. We had a very exciting American group, led by Stacey Keach, who believed in groups intermingling quite independently of the academy. We would rehearse outside school hours and chose what plays we wanted to do. The Americans cast and directed them from first, second and third year students. A Fulbright scholarship provided fees, lodgings, general maintenance and, when Stacey Keach was at Lambda in the mid-1960s, £15 a week for theatre trips and books, for which receipts were required. Fellow students gave Fulbright scholars their receipts. I would have thought it was quite good, 15 quid a week in the 1960s. Quite a lot of money, I would have thought. No other drama school had such a course, and it added lustre to the academy. There were teething problems. The course was abandoned for the 1961-62 academic year, when only four applicants survived auditions. A year later, it was restored, and in 1964, its performance of Kurt Mantel, directed by Christopher Fry, was reviewed in Plays and Players by Simon Trussler, who found that the Americans' enunciation of vowels bore traces of some vigorous English speak training. Lest his readers should mistake that remark for a compliment, he went on to say that this levelling down of ways of speech is one of the least fortunate aspects of drama school training. It may be done in the interest of clarity, but the end product is suited to the well-made drawing room play and precious little else. In another review, Trussler praised the students on the main acting course, who squeezed most of the menace from Pinter's The Dumb Waiter, but complained that they too were tripped up by their accents. In 1964, the Finance and General Purposes Committee reported that the overseas course was proving uneconomic, since its students paid only the standard Lambda fee, but being graduates, required the highest and most exacting standards of teaching and producing. The solution found was to raise the fees, and the course has since gone, with occasional hiccups, from strength to strength. So there you go, a brief history of the D's. I think that course now costs something like £24,000 with a bit of change. So that's now significantly more per year than the other courses, which cost around, well, the BA will cost around the £9,000 per year that all English BAs cost. So nearly, well, close to three times as much. Anyway, there you go. So that's a brief history of the D course. And now let's hear Charles Marowitz describe how he actually found it. So Marowitz writes, so I'm reading from books, so there'll be a bit of shuffling and paper turning. I apologize. There's the book, Marowitz's book, Burnt Bridges, A Souvenir of the Swinging 60s and Beyond, is brilliantly written. I think it's probably should be a book that more of us have read, or maybe you have. I'd never really come across it, but it's quite, it's of its time. Like Charles Marowitz as a character, I sort of read it and I was like, oh, this is brilliant. Then I found myself feeling a little bit disturbed. So I wouldn't dream of giving people a trigger warning, but just so you know, if you happen to decide to read Charles Marowitz, caveat emptor. There you go. That's an old-fashioned kind of warning. Anyway, so after having some adventures in a hostel in Earl's Court, Marowitz goes to Lambda and he says, "Once classes began at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, the institution in which I had been enrolled, thanks to the magnanimity of the GI Bill, the splendours and miseries of British life started to come in fast profusion. The principal of Lambda in 1956 was Michael McCowan, a short, bespectacled, reformed alcoholic director who was potty about Shakespeare and used to direct the bard with a copy of the folio spread on his lap, his gaze averted from the stage and his finger beating out the iambic pentameter. When an actor stressed the wrong syllable, neglected an elision, or ignored an enjambment, he would stop the rehearsal, point out the error, and then, the speech corrected, return to his folio and, with his gaze still averted, continue to audit the performance." One of the things that's fun about researching the history of drama schools is that you find echoes in the past of what you knew in the present. Now, nobody directed like that at Lambda. the faculty were superb, but a sort of a concern for verse and an interest in the folio certainly lingered. Rodney Cottier was not a director who would simply audit a performance. He was a very fine director and teacher, but I can see that he emerged from this tradition, let's say that. The staff at Lambda were quite respectable, consisting at various times of Catherine Lacey, don't know Catherine Lacey, Peter Coe, Michael Waugh, who Stephen Macht mentions in an earlier podcast, and the legendary voice coach Iris Warren, with much ballyhoo appearances from luminaries such as J.B. Priestley and Christopher Fry. It was Fry himself who directed a student production of The Firstborn, in which I played Aaron, one of the more unspeakable performances I essayed at Lambda. Almost as execrable as my Lord Foppington in The Country Wife, my inaudible King John, or my dandified and round-shouldered Lodovico in Othello. Genial, avuncular, soft-spoken, with the abstracted manner of a beatific nun, Fry used to imply that despite the dispassionate air, he was, spiritually speaking, getting it regularly. As a director, he was almost invisibly laid back, making arcane literary allusions through a smokescreen of pipe tobacco. He had a passion for run-throughs, and I remember one dress rehearsal night when, having once trotted through the whole goddamn biblical epic, his only note was that we trot through the whole damn thing again. At Lambda, I became aware for the first time of what the British, as opposed to the American, approach to acting was. According to the general perception, it was somewhat weighted towards technique and strong on voice and movement. In fact, it was exclusively concerned with externals and thoroughly oblivious to the concept of inner technique. Stanislavski was given mindless lip service. So that, I suppose, mindless lip service, hidden in plain sight, might be quite useful terms. I wonder if Vladimir Mirodan, I suspect, didn't read this, because I think it would have been useful in his paper on Harold Lang. But the only class which thematically touched on his ideas, a bi-weekly improvisation session conducted by Brian May, an instructor with one lung, who it was rumoured was subsidised by Dorothy L. Sayers, was a travesty of method work. The improvisations consisted of little playlets worked up by the students under the instructor's watchful eye, invariably followed by the question, "Well, how did it feel?" A question which regularly elicited vague and confused rejoinders from people who, having no objectivity of their own, were hungering after authoritative critiques. A rough kind of consensus more or less determined the success or failure of each playlet. And when some of the American students, who were versed on the method, ventured to suggest that work was devoid of appropriate actions, subtext, or palpable contact, the instructor merely blinked at this new terminology and went on to mount newer and more diverting playlets. Bitterly disillusioned, two of the more talented Americans resigned early in the term, and although I had an overwhelming urge to follow suit, my GI Bill subsidy was all I possessed, and had I foregone that, I would have had to leave England and return to America, which was by far the worse fate. So I soldiered on, gradually becoming the thorn in everyone's flesh, just as the school itself became an irrevocable one in my own. Irremovable one in my own. Yeah, it's an interesting description, isn't it? A criticism. Charles Marowitz was not the first, or maybe wouldn't be the last American to come and be disappointed by English actor training, although I think increasingly as the century wears on, Americans become excited and often satisfied by it. But I don't know, it'd be interesting. Maybe there are some Americans listening to this where this would chime some kind of familiar bell. Even Stephen Macht, who's incredibly complimentary about Lambda and had a wonderful time, I think if you listen to Stephen talking or read his dissertation, you can sense that sometimes he too is questioning certainly the depth of the inner work at this time. The situation at Lambda was complicated by two contradictory facts. On the whole, apart from some interesting work on verse technique and exposure to classical habits of thought from people like Waugh, Coe and McCowan, the training was puerile and backward, as ignorant of Stanislavski as it was of Brecht or Artaud. Acting was thought to be merely a mode for projecting language, and physical technique meant deportment almost exclusively. I wonder if either if he doesn't encounter some of the more innovative movement work that was going to was happening at Lambda or happened at Lambda, or maybe it hadn't happened yet. I don't know whether Trish Arnold had been recruited at this point. But interestingly, that to him, it's just deportment. Despite an innovative vocal approach by Iris Warren, later perpetuated by her disciple Kristen Linklater, who was at the school on the three-year course at this time. I wonder if he actually knew Kristen Linklater. The school's overriding philosophy was have a bash. Everyone was encouraged just to get on stage and do something. Exercise that modicum of talent which the staff acknowledged by accepting you in the first place, they seemed to say. Of course, having enrolled in America without an audition, the rancour against me was entirely justified. I had, as it were, snuck in to Lambda. As even the most perfunctory examination would have revealed, such a moiety of acting talent that I would probably have been requested to cut short the audition speech. Intellectually and artistically, the school was a kind of British bulwark for the Boulevard Theatre, which was just beginning to crumble and which, in 5 years, would be in disarray. But its poisonous mole and most outspoken critic was an inept and gormless young man with a goatee who could not act, was unapologetically antisocial, and seemed to spend most of his time seducing the female students. The paradox was that we were both right. It was a ghastly institution, and from an acting standpoint, I was its most lustreless fixture. Gradually, it dawned upon me that given the breadth of my physical and vocal inadequacies, I was not intended for a berth in the professional theatre. But it had never occurred to me how implicitly this view was already held by the staff. It was dramatically brought home to me during a rehearsal of Othello, conducted by André von Gissingen, an old-styled leftist married to a permanently inebriated Jean Forbes Robertson, daughter of the great old classical actor, who had latterly become a traditionalist director. I was Lodovico at the time, and had just performed the speech, "O Spartan dog, more fell than anguish, hunger or the sea, look on the tragic loading of this bed," which, in previous rehearsals, used to saunter by in stony silence, although my private antennae regularly picked up a tiny tremor emitted by the director. On this occasion, as I sailed into the speech, Van Gissingen leapt from his stool, threw down the prompt book, and screeched in a tone that brought the plaster peeling from the ceilings, "It's not Spartan dog, it's Spartan dog. Spartan dog. Dog." His fury at my New York pronunciation was quite the most Shakespearean moment I ever experienced at Lambda, made even more memorable by the intensity of its volume and the falling shrapnel impact of its rhetorical flourish. Being a breach of student-teacher protocol, Van Gissingen was very apologetic afterwards, although I was more regaled by the theatricality of the outburst than I was by its critical implications. A year or so later, by then sponging off the US government at the Central School of Speech and Drama, I can remember incidents when Clifford Turner, the doyen of British speech teachers, loosed a similar barrage of invective against certain American students. Lazy speech and gutter diphthongs in academies such as Lambda and the Central School, desecration of the Queen's English was a serious transgression for Tory diehards trying to civilize the natives. When the floodgates opened and drama schools actually encouraged the preservation of regional accents, North Country growls, Mamaset drawls, and even Cockney glottal stops, it was a sure sign that the empire was shrinking into the sea and a new and terrible age dawning for the British theatre. Although very little drama training was absorbed, it was a period, and then he goes off and does all kinds of wonderful things. There's quite a lot of stuff in there. I've got a feeling that passage for any of you who are interested in the history of the British Drama School is quite useful. As I say, it's in his book, Burnt Bridges, A Souvenir of the Swinging 60s and Beyond. Pretty damning, of course. Marowitz sort of puts his money where his mouth is in terms of his views and sets up all kinds of things in London during the 50s and then into the 60s and stays in the UK, I think, until something like the 1980s. Interestingly, if you ever do something, if you're a student and you do something like what's sometimes called an exploded Shakespeare, a sort of a response to Shakespeare's plays, sometimes people do things using some of the text and some devised text or some post-dramatic material, or people devise around a play and produce a brand new play. All of that, I think, can be traced to some degree back to Marowitz's experiments. I was quite surprised to find a review, not surprised, but interested to find a review of one of Charles Marowitz's books by Jeff Bullen, who still teaches at RADA. Jeff, during a brief tenure as head of the BA acting course, tried to introduce a sort of exploded Shakespeare project. Interestingly, at the time, I think that the consensus from the students, not entirely an entirely singular view, was that perhaps the project was not quite what they wanted at that stage in their training. I wonder if they think differently about it now. But now I realise from Jeff Bullen's very favourable review of a book of Charles Marowitz's that he was a fan. So I understand to a degree the roots of his interest in doing that kind of work with Shakespeare's texts. Anyway, so that's 1956, and that's. Except that's something like what the drama school was like, and I'd be very surprised if RADA was any different. I would actually expect it to be less radical, and the Guildhall and the other major drama schools, Central School of Speech and Drama, I would have thought would be similar to the way that Marowitz describes things at Lambda. And then there's a sort of a revolution, and in 1963, the sort of the clearest expression of that is the foundation of the Drama Centre. We've heard something of this story before, but essentially there's a row between faculty and a group of teachers, and then the whole of a cohort leave and found a brand new drama school, which was called the Drama Centre and is still just going. A few years later, 7 years after that, Simon Callow goes. And so let's hear now what British drama training is like. So a sort of a compare and contrast, 1956 to 1970, 14 years. Is that a long time? 14 years? I don't think 14 years is that long a time, is it? 14 years feels like a fairly brief time. So I'll pick it up from when Simon Callow has got in. On Sunday, 27th of September, 1970, I sat down in my room on Primrose Hill. £5, 12 shillings, sixpence per week. How would I pay for that? And wrote myself a letter. It begins. Tomorrow, I start at the Drama Centre. I am terrified. I dread the total exposure. It seems to me that one will be obliged to make a full and immediate declaration of personality, lay all one's cards on the table. However this might terrify me now, it is in fact my whole reason for engaging in the enterprise. Through my crucifixion, I expect my redemption. Blimey. To bring me at least face to face with myself, warts and all, beauty spots and all, is the object of the exercise. I say this with some shame. The object of the Drama Centre is to produce actors. I may become an actor. Indeed, at the moment, I can't think of anything else that I could be. But my main purpose in pursuing this course is therapeutic. Perhaps that's what acting is to all actors. And perhaps all acting is almost accidental, a sort of symptom or cure of an illness, produced, like the pearl, by grit. Good writing there from a young Simon Callow in 1970 in Primrose Hill. This could be the beginning, not of a new life, but of life itself. Shall I really begin to live? At no time have I truly felt myself in life, always in the wings, watching closely sometimes, often bored, finding ways of amusing myself, but never for long, because the real world was always out there. But now, suddenly, I'm on. I ended by wishing myself luck. The next night, I wrote. It's touching, isn't it? Those of you heading off, anybody listening who's going to go to drama school, maybe this all connects to you. The next night I wrote, it's not too late to leave. Everyone is better than I am. They look better, read better, mix, talk, act better. I must be mad to have come here at all. I'm so nervous that when I try to reply to my wisecracking neighbour, my mouth works, but no words come. At first, it was difficult to believe that one had really made it here at last. It seemed unreal, and one was basking in the glory of this achievement, when one was suddenly rolled over into the deep end. Then it was hard to connect what was being said with what had brought one here. The tone is practical, undeceived, and undeceiving. He wrote that, by the way, that's not his description. The tone is practical, undeceived. A little heartbreaking, isn't it? I'm sure all of us, or most of us, many of us, know that feeling. Everybody's better than us. Agonizing. Actor training is agonizing, or there is agony in it. Simon Callow goes on. In fact, it was incredibly hard going to begin with. I didn't seriously for a moment doubt that I'd come to the right place. It was so bracing, like Gordonston. I joked to myself, it was some while before I could actually talk to other people, that perhaps one should collect a Duke of Edinburgh award with one's diploma. I was terribly impressed by the triumvirs who ran the school. Yat Malmgren, Christopher Fettes, and John Blatchley. Searching, visionary, and practical, respectively, I thought them on that first day. Later, I felt that they had taught me in turn the what, the why, and the how of acting. One worked terribly hard, starting with a movement class at 9, through classes in Yat's bewildering work. Christopher's blazing account of world drama at a single arc from its ritual origins through to the present day. A rigorous account of the Stanislavski work. John Blatchley's, he was always Mr. Blatchley, mask work, voice work, and ending with work on a play. We finally fell out at 7, running home to prepare for the next day. I, of course, then went off to slave over box office accounts from half of London's theatres, and at the weekend to tear tickets for the National Theatre's audience. Thank God for that job. Not only did it pay me a few bob, but the friendly bar manager, Max Maxwell, knowing my straits, used to fill a great brown paper sack every Saturday night with whatever was left over from the buffet. I would stand on Waterloo Station, staggering under this huge Red Cross parcel full of salmon sandwiches, shrimp canapes, lumps of cheese, tomatoes, bottles of milk, and loaves of French bread. For 3 days, I ate like a Nassus, then back to my short commons of 2 eggs a day, packet soups, and various cans furnished by my mother. She had a particular weakness for giant gherkins, which I could never share. In general, the diet was beneficial. I lost weight and looked better, though I was, of course, very tired. It was quite obvious that another term of this kind of regimen was out of the question. One day, Christopher Fettes told me he'd managed to pull a string and that my application for a grant would be reconsidered by ILEA, that's the Inner London Educational Authority, now defunct. This time, instead of power-crazed housewives and superannuated drama advisers, the committee consisted of officials and an actor, Paul Daneman, whom I'd so loved as Richard III 10 years before. This is the strange, curious time in the British drama school when you could get a grant to go to drama school, but it was administered by your local education authority. So people would often do an audition for their drama school and get in, and then they'd have to an audition for a panel at the local education authority who would decide whether or not to give them a grant, a discretionary grant. Sometimes I think we look back on this period with slightly rose-tinted glasses, as if everyone automatically got wonderful grants to go to drama schools. That was not the case, or at least it was not always the case. I think my panegyric to Wolfit, His performances during the Blitz and the heroic touring work rang some kind of a bell. At any rate, I was awarded a full grant, and life seemed full to overflowing. I was commended at the end-of-term interview for industry, and for, as Christopher Fettes put it, unsuspected reserves of kindness. I brought him a cup of coffee very late one night when he was struggling with some impossible lighting plot. Little did I suspect, flushed with my grant, intellectually stimulated as I'd never been at university, and plain punch drunk from exhaustion, that my position in the school hung by a thread. The fact is that I wasn't doing very well at all. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that at this point at the Drama Centre, and indeed in many other schools, students were sometimes asked to leave, something that I think haunted students until quite recently. When I was teaching at RADA, for instance, students often seemed to fear that they might be chucked out, something that was never going to happen. I mean, asked to leave because of a lack of ability or talent. I wonder if that was some kind of folk memory of the not very far away time when that actually happened. The school's work in almost every department demanded fundamental adjustments of thought. It's not that the work is difficult. It's certainly hard. It requires application and discipline and concentration. But you don't need a PhD to understand it. The Stanislavski system, for example, which the Drama Centre teaches with absolute fidelity to his texts, not Lee Strasberg's. We've been talking about how that's a sort of complicated thought, actually. Like, what does it mean, his texts? But anyway, fair enough. That's what Simon Callow thought at the time. Is essentially very simple. Some would say too simple. What's hard is getting it into one's bones. Similarly, Yat's work, though resting on a very complicated and rather beautiful theoretic structure, is at heart a work of identifying and utilising sensations. I was avid for ideas, eagerly debating with the teachers the validity of this or that proposition, extrapolating philosophical truths from theoretic crumbs. I was very high. All my dreams, ravings, visions and aspirations were at last feeding into something practical and important. The Drama Centre buzzed with the sense that we were engaged in work which was essential to the well-being of society, the survival of the race and the affirmation of art. It was like being an intelligence during the war. Deadly serious, semi-secret, requiring 100% commitment and there's a war on. I couldn't have been happier being a Drama Centre student. The only snag was I couldn't do the work. Exercise after exercise failed, but not usefully or instructively. It failed because I wasn't really doing the exercise. This sort of passionate political energy, this faith, is something that the Drama Centre was very successful at filling people up with. My first job as an acting teacher was on an MA course at Arts Ed, and the course leader was a man called Adrian James. And I can still recall the power of Adrian's speeches, especially at graduation. He would often give a speech at graduation, and it was always a magnificent thing. And I think I understand now something of where that comes from, and it comes from this very particular energy that lived inside the Drama Centre. The problem, of course, was Simon Callow. And by the way, that energy has filled all kinds of other drama schools. So in the same sense, same way that the teachers of the Old Vic School and to some degree the London Theatre Studio went off and became the leadership of all kinds of schools, something very similar happened with the Drama Centre. The problem, of course, was Simon Callow. That skillfully fashioned and perfectly credible suit of armour remained obstinately in place. I had assumed, like all virgins, that the loss of my virginity would transform my life, that problems would vanish, and one would take one's place with swarming humanity. Well, I lost it, good and proper, in the first week of term, and spent some time in an undignified attempt to make up for wasted time. But it was Simon Callow who lost his virginity, not me. Blah, 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 I went. In bed and out, blah, 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 in exercises, blah, 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 or its physical equivalent in movement classes. Kinetic codswallop. My aim in all these areas was to entertain, to impress, to amuse. It all happened a millimetre beneath my scalp. I can quite distinctly remember going home, sitting at the table in my little flat and thinking of droller and droller quips for use in improvisations. It was no wonder that the staff became impatient with me. They must have felt that there was something there, but that I was deliberately refusing to let it out. They were right. The ingenuity I expended on justifying what I was trying to do was of a high creative order. My devotion to outer man, putting him through his paces, making him do this funny voice or that, indicate this emotion or that, was total. It's not as if they were asking for anything earth-shattering. I, of course, thought I was giving them something earth-shattering. The early work, in every class, was simplicity itself. Stanislavski is based squarely on the concept of action. So remember, this is 1970. In the 1950s, Marowitz, Vladimir Mirodan, they're saying really that Stanislavski is given no more than lip service. It's nothing. This is different, though. So now we have a school which is teaching acting properly. You might disagree with it, but it's definitely doing it. Stanislavski is based squarely on the concept of action, that everything in a play is done in order to achieve a want of some kind. This resolves into the formula. Objective, what do I want? Action, what do I do to get it? Obstacle, what stands in my way? The action subdivides into activities, the separate means that I use to get what I want. There are inner actions, which I use on myself, and outer actions, on other people. Inner obstacles, my problems, and outer obstacles, the problem of other people. The whole sequence of actions in a play adds up to the character's superobjective, their whole thrust in the world of the play. I don't think I've oversimplified. There's more to it than that, but the theory of actions is the core of the whole work, and it couldn't be simpler. Well, it probably could be simpler, Simon Callow, but fair enough, it's certainly not impossible to grasp, good. At first, I resisted it intellectually. No one ever wrote a play to this formula, I said, and it's true. No one ever did. But Stanislavski wasn't writing inductively. He was writing from observation of actors who we wouldn't call method actors at all, particularly the great Italian actor Salvini. No. I submitted to the theory soon enough. But doing the really childishly simple exercises, I want the money, X has it, what do I do to get it, proved impossible. We all had the most enormous difficulty in thinking in terms of actions, just to formulate them in terms of transitive verbs, as they obviously must be, seemed brain-bustingly difficult. Wild-eyed students would roam the purlieus of the college, feverishly ransacking Roger's thesaurus, only to have their favoured verb shot down in flames by the teacher. In order to what, they'd demand. What means are you using? God, it was tough. Like training for the SAS. It's probably just very briefly worth mentioning that some of these ideas, this sort of theory of this way of applying Stanislavski, which is very particular, it can be criticised in all kinds of ways. For me, the biggest problem was to show my... Although, having said that, the Drama Centre trained some pretty damn fine actors. For me, the biggest problem is to show myself wanting something. To want anything is to put oneself into a position of frightening vulnerability, and then to pursue a course of action to achieve that want is to show oneself at one's most naked. It can be very ugly. Under no circumstances was I prepared to do that. I quipped. I postured. I clowned. I devised quite complicated scenarios, not lacking in literary worth. What I would not do was to show anything of myself. Without my doing that, I was wasting my time and everyone else's. Fun and games, Doreen Cannon would say laconically. I don't believe it. Fetis would roar. The whole question, I don't believe it, was a classic Doreen Cannon response. The whole question of emotional truth was one on which we all got desperately stuck. The early exercises encourage the hang-up, but they're indispensable. To give in to one's emotion in the company of one's peers, to be able to taste them in order to use them eventually, is essential. And without emotional freedom, nothing will happen. Because the expression of wants will be forever inhibited. Follow your impulses, Mrs. Cannon would drawl through gum. You may never have another. Doreen was the principal teacher of Stanislavski, a pupil herself of Uta Hagen, and through her, in the direct line of succession from Strasbourg. Not that Doreen was a slavish adherent of Strasbourg's, but emotional truth she demanded. Oh, did she ever? We'll talk when we talk to folk next week about Doreen's line. Uta Hagen definitely. Uta Hagen connects, I think, more to Harold Klerman and perhaps to Stella Adler than Lee Strasberg. But of course, Klerman was involved in setting up the group theatre. So yes, okay, so definitely connected to the American method. When I had tackled my emotional inhibitions head on in the notorious emotion memory exercise, nothing had happened. The form of the exercise is that the student lies on a couch while his fellow students sit around him in a circle. In an atmosphere of intense concentration, the teacher leads him to reconstruct an event of great emotional intensity. Extreme tears, extreme panic, extreme laughter. Detail by detail, the teacher leads him. And what colour was the wallpaper? Describe the furniture. What were you wearing? Was it hot? And so on, until the subject enters completely into the past, leaving the present behind. I'm trying to write, but the pen is broken, so I put it down and open a drawer, which is empty. So I try another, and then the door opens, and my uncle walks into the room. What do you want, uncle? Why are you looking at me like that? No, I don't want to. I'm frightened. No. Please. The results are often extraordinary. Girls with tiny Minnie Mouse voices suddenly bellow like oxen. Stoics weep hysterically. Po-faced people laugh till the tears run down their faces. My own flatmate reconstructed his expulsion from monastery school. As the memory took hold, he fell out of his chair onto the floor, dragging himself along the ground with his bare hands, his fingernails digging into the floorboards, emitting a terrifying growl from the pit of his stomach. He crawled behind the piano, panting, eyes flashing. The teacher was visibly rattled, and so were we all. It was hot stuff, and we all felt that if acting wasn't about confronting oneself in the darkest alleys of one's life, what was it? Giving vent to the creatures in one's own black lagoon, in the presence and with the support of one's closest colleague, might enable one to give them to the audience, too. Just pausing there briefly, I think it's that kind of actor training exercise, which done in good faith in the Drama Centre of Simon Callow. But it's that kind of exercise that perhaps gave some aspects of actor training a bad name, maybe unfairly, maybe fairly, I don't know. Certainly when I was training to be an actor, that was sort of going out of fashion, I think. I didn't go to drama school, but when I was around acting workshops, there was some kind of a shift had taken place and a suspicion that perhaps sometimes in the wrong hands, that kind of approach to actor training, which is clearly crossing a line into the therapeutic, is unhealthy and potentially, I suppose, abusive. So I don't know any school where an exercise quite like that is still done. There may be ones, not the ones that I taught at. Simon Callow goes on to say, it just didn't work for me, that's all. How disappointed I was in myself. I had dredged up a memory which had certainly been traumatic at the time. I'd been in hospital, having my tonsils out. I was due to leave. My mother arrived to fetch me. I got dressed and packed when the doctor said, better just have one last checkup, just for safety's sake. He did, and I had a slight temperature, so I had to stay for another day. That's all. But the effect on a 7-year-old was understandably devastating. I howled and howled till dawn, and after a tonsillectomy, that's no joke. I thought it was the end of the world. Step by step, the teacher took me through the details. I don't know whether it's Doreen. Which bed were you in? What colour were your pyjamas, etc.? Slowly, I felt myself falling like Alice through the hole. Emotions began to well, but then, at the crucial moment, some inner clamp sat on them, and though I whimpered somewhat, it remained a trickle, not a torrent. It was Doreen Cannon who opened the floodgates. Scene. The classroom at the drama centre, called the church, the room in which my right leg had hammered its quarter metal tattoo. Up there, on that same concrete stage, I was about to perform a life and death exercise, an extreme situation calling for desperate measures. These, I think, are what are sometimes called object exercises, emerging from the work of Uta Hagen. Not Stanislavski. My scenario was to return home from work early and find my girl in bed with another man. I entered, surveyed the scene coldly, uttered withering phrases, shamed by my sang-froid, and sulked after the man left. Altogether, I behaved much as people do in West End dramas about infidelity, or indeed, for all I know, in life. The script was, though I say it myself, rather fine, polished, and accurate, and economical. Mrs. C. thought otherwise. "Don't believe it," she almost yawned. "Is that really what you'd do if you found your girl in bed with another man? Oh dear, I am sorry for you both. Not me, lady," I nearly said. "The character, you know, him. Except that in the method, one never says him, only me." I bit my tongue and thought, "Pearls before swine, too bad you can't see it." But then I thought, "I'm sick of this. Day in, day out, wine, wine, it's never good enough for you. I'm always made to feel emotionally impotent. Well, I'm not." Through these fumings, I heard the New York accent wearily say, "Okay, let's try it again. Only this time, try to give yourself a chance." Without replying, I turned on my heels, walked out of the room, and paced up and down outside, waiting for the cue to begin the scene, gorging like a hungry dog on my hatred of the woman. "Okay, let's go," the drool drawled. I opened the door. I spied the adulterous couple. A noise like a lion's roar came from my throat. I seized the man, plucked him out of the bed, and hurled him across the room. The girl came to me pleading and sobbing. I flung her back on the bed. I rent her clothes into tiny shreds. The man, genuinely frightened, said, "Simon." Another roar, and I picked up a three-piece settee and smashed it on the ground. It broke in half. Anne, the girl, by now, really, as herself, terrified, started to cry. "I've never seen you like this before. Stop it, stop it. Great," came a cry from the room. "Great, that's what it's all about. Do you see that? Do you understand that?" she said to the class. "That is a breakthrough." A newly, unfamiliarly animated Doreen came up to me. "Great. Well done. You should be very pleased." I was still a bit shaken by the mighty emotions which had been passing through me and had not altogether forgiven Doreen for provoking them, so I just nodded. Later, people who'd been there repeated her praise and said, "Wow," and such like. It took me a day to work out what had happened. Yes, interesting. The breakthrough. Again, I think somewhat out of fashion in the drama school, although a thing that certainly operated upon me. I wonder where these things come from. I wonder how we think we know stuff. Because I hadn't read this book. I didn't read Simon Callow's Being an Actor when I was 18 or 19 or 20, but I somehow feel like I had. I feel like that's what I wanted when I did acting classes. Nobody, certainly not Doreen, and not even I, thought it was good acting. What it was a powerful emotion carried through to its conclusion. The remarkable thing was not the emotion, but that I had allowed myself to show it, to show myself. On reflection, I realized that for as long as I could remember, I had never shown myself to be angry. I regarded it as undignified and bad policy. I believed that the moment one lost one's temper, one became weak. I certainly never used physical violence, even as a child. I probably thought, tiny as I then was, that I was bound to lose any physical contest. And here I was, hurling people across the stage and roaring like a wild animal. It was obviously all there inside me, and when I gave into it, my voice, my body, and my whole stance changed. I felt enormous power and freedom. I did, in fact, feel alive. My dream was being fulfilled. It seemed that my breakthroughs must always come obliquely. The great one, the one that transformed all my attitudes, came neither in the Stanislavski work or Yat's work, but in Christopher Fettes' class, Analysis. This class dealing with the origins and growth of the drama was always my favourite, because to me, it was everything university should have been, but never was. Christopher has a spontaneous intellectual expressionism, seeing history and art in starkly vivid terms, plugging all human experience into a vision of the human condition, part Freudian, part Nietzschean, theatre embodying the struggle against oblivion, the celebration of desire, a licensed revolt against society, and at the same time, civilization's opposition to anarchy. His eclecticism was radical. Euripides' Orestes would be illuminated by Lou Reed. Wedekind's Spring Awakening made sense of in terms of German romantic excess, Richard Strauss, Liebestod. The feature of this class was that we did it ourselves. A chronological sequence of topics central to dramatic history, Dionysus, the Greek city-state, Spanish Commedia, Molière and so on, was doled out. Each acting student with a partner, usually a student director, was then required to present it to the class, in whatever form he chose. One could lecture, or write a play, or make a documentary, whatever was the most vivid. The form was free. My first subject was Pericles and the Greek city-state. With Penny Churns, I co-wrote it and co-directed it, and I'd written myself a leading role as Testicles, a kind of Athenian Alf Garnett. Talking to Penny Churns next week, I wonder if she still has Pericles and the Greek city-state somewhere. In all the anxiety over the show, worrying whether it was clear, whether everybody knew where to come on or go off, I had no time to think about my performance, no time to wonder about its effect on the group, or on Christopher, or to ask, was I funny, or was it clever? I just did it. Suddenly, for the first time, I was acting, not performing, or posturing, or puppeteering. I was being in another way. At a stroke, the mask that I had screwed onto my face fell away. I was free, easy, effortless. For the first time since I'd arrived at the drama centre, I understood what playing a character was. It was giving in to another way of thinking. Giving in was the essential experience. Leave yourself alone, they'd been saying to us since the day we arrived. Now, suddenly, I was. To my surprise, I found that it was not an entirely unfamiliar sensation. Even at his uptight, armoured worst, Simon Callow had always been able to forget himself in the temporary assumption of another identity, for a line in a funny story, or for the devastating impersonation of a tutor. It was here, if anywhere, that any talent for acting that I might possess had resided. The knack of throwing off self-consciousness and finding, however briefly, a pool of liberated energy which was nothing to do with how I presented myself in life. My overawe at the intellectual framework of the drama centre and my emotional constipation had snuffed the little flame out, and with it, spontaneity. It had seemed unworthy. When I saw that it was the same thing, that was it, the direct flow of energy transforming the brain, the heart and the body, I was as one reborn. It was then, in that moment, that acting became second nature to me. I was unstoppable. I had the taste of the thing in my mouth. From being a spectator, dragging myself up to do exercises that I felt doomed to fail in, I suddenly couldn't perform enough. I volunteered to be in everyone else's improvisations and exercises as well as my own. It wasn't to be seen. It wasn't to impress. It was to do it. To revel in this newly discovered joy. To romp around in the adventure playground that I myself had become. This epiphany fell almost exactly halfway through the training. Before and after were as day from night. I wonder what the staff made of this sudden transformation. It coincided with a second year production of a Phaedre farce, in which I played with great freedom and flair, so they probably attributed it to that. But it was post hoc, not propter hoc. Of course, the fact that Admirable Grenville Hallam had come, as it were, from the world outside to do the production and approached it much as he might have approached a professional production, assuming that all the usual work of the school had been done but never using it himself, was an enormous advantage. I was able to consolidate my breakthrough. Might leave Simon Callow's account of the Drama Centre there for today and complete the rest in another podcast, just because I don't want this podcast to become ludicrously long. Things to think about. Well, firstly, as I was hoping to sort of argue, I suppose, that's a very different school from the one that Charles Marowitz goes to. So a revolution has taken place, certainly in the Drama Centre. I think that revolution spread out to other schools, and perhaps revolutions had taken place in other schools at that time. And also the thing I'm musing upon is how fascinating it is that what Simon Callow describes finally as his breakthrough is in a part of the curriculum where you might not possibly expect it. And that's always something to think about, I think, when training or when devising trainings or when running a drama school, that you never quite know where people make the connections that they need to make, where they understand the things that sometimes change the direction of their lives. And I don't know how you predict that or control that, but perhaps it's just useful to remember that a variety of things has some value. So I'll leave it there for the moment and return to the rest of Simon's accounts in a little while. I hope that was of some interest to you. There's been no big news in the drama school recently, although I suspect a story may be brewing. Anyhow, I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. It's been a nice, mild, grey summer so far. I quite like that. I don't like it when it's too hot. Brilliant. Well, take care. Bye.